your unsatisfactory life as it is right now is what the Buddha was pointing to as suffering. That's what Buddha was pointing to the path of. This is what the Buddha. This is why the Buddha pointed the path out of. Okay. And the Buddha taught for. The Buddha died at the age of 81, I believe. I don't know. He started teaching around the age of 29. So I don't know. You do the math. He taught for some 50 or something years. And for those 50 or so years, he taught every day. So his collected sayings have been canonized into what is called the Dharma, okay, the Sutra and the Tantra, the collection of Sutra and Tantra, the Tripitaka, the three baskets, Dhinnasum. I don't know, that's the only language I know for that. Okay. And in all those teachings, the Buddha was essentially saying one thing. And we read it when we were paying homage to the Buddha. The homage of the Buddha, by the way, the first paragraph, you find it in every Buddhist community, whether it is Tibetan, whether it is Southeast Asian, whether it is Chinese, Japanese, they all have this. It's in many of the sutras. As a matter of fact, the Buddha, when the Buddha is talking about another Buddha, he uses the same words. Okay. So this wasn't created by some person. And just because I say it wasn't created by some person, those words, it was not created by some person, doesn't give it some glory, glorified meaning, glorified essence. Okay. I'll explain that later. I will confuse you towards the end of the class, I promise you, okay? The middle part of it was written by the author of this work. The three principles, the three principal paths, Lamso Namso. The middle part of it was written by Jeson Kapa, of course, to praise the Buddha. When you get to do not commit any non-virtues, Jeson Kapa's work ends. This is the actual word of the Buddha. This comes from the sutra, where the Buddha himself gives a summary of everything that he's been teaching so far. All these words for those many years, for those decades of years that I've been teaching you, this is their essence. Do not commit any non-virtuous actions. Perform only perfect virtuous actions. Subdue your mind thoroughly. And he said, this is the teachings of the Buddha. And when he said, this is the teaching of the Buddha, this is the English translation. And some translation, it says, this is the teachings of the Buddhas. Whoever is called a Buddha, this is what they're going to teach you. This is their teaching. They may teach you Tantra, they may teach you Sutra, they may teach you only a certain path to reach path to, there's one Chinese teacher a long time ago called the path to heaven, Heaven Yana. And Heaven Yana means, within Buddhism, just one of those realms where you're happy for a very long time, but you're still in samsara, okay? So there's Heaven Yana, there's out of samsara Yana, there's Bodhisattva Yana, okay? So whichever Yana the Buddha is teaching, its essence is the same. Whether you're Bodhisattva, whether you're trying to reach the state, whether you're trying to become the next Brahma or the next Shiva, this is what you have to do. Do not commit any non-virtuous actions. Perform only perfect virtuous actions. Subdue your mind thoroughly. And by that, by those means, you can achieve the state of Shiva, the state of Brahma, or you can achieve a state of arhathood, or you can become one of those mighty beings called a bodhisattva, and eventually become a blissfully omniscient one. Okay. Wait a minute. Can you think of it? Blissfully omniscient one is just the translation for tathagata and sugata. Okay. I just try to fool you a moment ago. Okay. So here's the story of this book now comes in. Of course, at the same time, I have to cover the questions in the homework. So I already mentioned it. The author of the work is Jeson Kapa. When he was ordained, his name was Losang Dagpa. Okay. Some of you probably have heard the Sanskrit translation of it, Sumati Kirti. Okay, Sumati is a losang, and Takpa is Kirti, like Dhamma Kirti, Chuki Takpa. Okay. He became known as Jason Kapa, just like it's something that the Tibetans just love to do. They love to not call you by the name that you're given. Okay. They love to give you, just make up a name for you. So his made up name was Jason Kapa. It means the Lord who came from the valley of Tsongkha. Okay. Tsongkha was the place where Jason Kapa was born, so he became known, the one who came from Tsongkha. Okay. The pa at the end of the name just means the one. Okay. This is the only date that I remember in all the classes that Geshe Michael taught. He was born in 1357, died in 1419. And don't ask me for any other dates. That's the only date that I remember. Probably because this book impressed me so much, and I heard that this book has impressed a lot of people when they read it. You read this book and you say, towards the end, and you go back again, you could keep doing the same thing, go back again, go back to it many times until it becomes very torn, and maybe you buy another copy, or maybe you keep it as a momentum, and you probably tape it up like I did, so it wouldn't be deteriorating any further. Anyway, this is not the first book that I got, okay? That book, I have no idea what happened to it. I know I lost the cover, I lost a few pages, but I was very impressed by it. So, but this book contains within it the Lamso Namsum. Lamso Namsum is only like a few verses long. And a lot of people memorize the verses. I remember memorizing it because I was very impressed by it. But as time went on, because I didn't rehearse it, all I know is that I memorized it. Tell me exactly what's in it. Maybe I can say there's in there Lama. Okay? I don't remember the exact words. Okay. But the most of the book is the work which is a commentary on the Lamso Namsum written by Pabongka Rinpoche. Okay. And of course, Pabongka Rinpoche, that's not his real name. It's the name that they love to give him. And he has several names. Pabongka was a monastery somewhere in Tibet. And when Pabongka Rinpoche was born, they saw that there was something special about him, but they didn't know exactly what. When he was taken to the monastery at a very early age, the teacher to whom he was taken to thought perhaps maybe this is my teacher, and then he did his whatever he had to do, divination, and tried to see if it was his teacher, because he was so impressed by this young monk. But it wasn't his teacher, so he asked him to go to Sera. And when he was in Sera, he stayed at the Gyalwang house. And I think England had the same sort of system in their universities, where people from different parts of England, they would like sleep in one place, and that place became known as that place from those people who came from that place. So the same thing also happened, same phenomenon happened in Tibet. Sera is actually a little village, okay, a little village of monks, literally. I'm talking about just Sera Me itself. Sera is divided into Sera Me and Sera Je. Okay? Sera, and don't let the names fool you, because Sera Me, people from Sera Me will tell you Sera Me is better than Sera Je. And people from Sera Je will tell you, they just say that just to make themselves feel better. Sera Me itself sometime had 10,000 monks. Okay? Not counting the monks from also from Sera Je. Okay? So Sera itself as a monastic center was a village. And in Sera Me there were many houses, and the houses, or not really, they call them houses, but not really houses, but like probably a little cluster of houses where monks from just one place would just congregate. And because it would make it easier for them for the transition, because they were young, if they stayed with people from their own place, they would feel, they would be, what's that word? Or become accustomed, or become acclimated. You become acclimated faster. I mean, imagine a 7-year-old or an 8-year-old, and you're thrown away. You walk. I mean, by the time you reach Sera, you're probably 8 or 9, and years journey away from your home. So you're stuck there, literally. And many of the monks never really are able to go back. And for them to actually, when they finish their studies, or maybe when they're about to finish their studies, then they would make a pilgrimage back home. And that would take many months for them to do so. So when they arrive in Serra, which is very far from their home, sort of make them feel at home, they would put them in the place where people from their hometown would be. Okay? So Pabongka Nweche was put in Galong House, a place called Galong House. Okay. And the reason for the popularity of Galong House, because Kem Nweche, that's where he was, Galong House. And of course, I'm not from Galong, but that's the house where I am sort of formally, what's that place? What's it called? My association with Serame. When I became, I went to the abbot, and then I was ordained in New Jersey by Ken Boucher. And then a few years later, actually the same year when this class was first taught, I think, that's when I was ordained. And I went to, Serra, and I became an official monk of Serame, and within Galong House. So when Pabongka Nweche went to Galong House, he studied well, and he impressed his friends because of the way he debated. And he wasn't a great debater, and it wasn't like he was fast. It was just that he kept it practical. He kept it to his own experience, and he didn't care whether he lost the debate or not. What he was concerned was it practical? Was the outcome the truth? Was it beneficial? And because he wasn't such a great debater, he received his geshe degree, but he didn't receive the highest geshe degree. He received what is called a lingse degree. The lingse degree is there's the lingse, there's the sokramba, there's even there are like 5 degrees of geshes, and the highest is larampa. And within the larampa, there are grades like first larampa, second larampa, third larampa. Okay, you can imagine the first larampa is considered to be like the first, like the best scholar within the country in that year. Okay, and only there can only be one first larampa for that year. Okay, and of course, Geshe Lobsang Dachin, Kenimbeche Geshe Lobsang Dachin was a first degree larampa geshe, and to become a larampa geshe is already tough. Okay, and to become the first among the larampas is, you can imagine. Okay. So after 23 years of studying, you have 5 years of just examinations. Okay. And that's for the Geshe exam. And they want to make sure that you are worthy to become a member of their club. Okay. And he was teaching extensively throughout Tibet, and he made a great following. And he was also known as Dechen Ningbo, because they consider him to be a great someone who has realized many of the path of the secret teachings. Okay. Dechen Ningbo means, Dechen means great bliss, and Ningbo means essence. So he was called like the essence of great bliss. Okay. When Pabongka Nweche was born, the teacher thought that he was exceptional, and they were trying to find out who he was. It wasn't until some time while he was studying at Galong House in Serame was he discovered to be the reincarnation of Chöngya Rinpoche Dorje. Okay. Chöngya Rinpoche was a very famous teacher in the past who actually went and taught in the court of the emperors of China. And because about that time, the relationship between Tibet and China wasn't. This was about the time of the period where the transition was about to take place. Okay. So they decided not to call him Chöngya because of the political implications. And it was also discovered that he was also in his previous life was an abbot of a monastery in Pabongka. Okay. Pabongka. So that's why he became known as Pabongka Rinpoche. So Pabongka Kentul. Ken means former abbot. That's why we call Rinpoche Ken Rinpoche. Ken is the Tibetan word for Kenbo. Okay? So Ken, no, Another thing that Tibetans love to do, they love to abbreviate. Okay? So it was Kenpo Tulku. So they abbreviated that to Kentul. What they would do is take the first syllable of each name and then they make it into one name and call it Kentul. Some of you probably have met Geshe Lothar. The Lothar is Losang Talpa. Okay, so that's why Losang Tal De. So that's why it's called Lothar, because like I said before, Tibetans will not call you by your given name. And later on in his own writings, and I'm gonna confuse you, okay? This is the information to help you with the confusion. Later on in his own writing, he didn't say it directly, but you will read it somewhere in the introduction, where he said that he thinks that he is also the one for whom Jeson Kapa wrote the Three Principal Path. Okay, and the one for whom Jeson Kapa wrote this, well, the Three Principal Path, it was a student of Jeson Kapa. His name was Tsako Wambo. I mean, that's what he was called, Tsako Wambo. That wasn't his name, obviously. His name was Ngaung Dakpa. Tsako Wambo the translation for it is like a monk, a friar. Wangbo means just, you know, the friar who's called Wangbo. Okay, Wang, okay? So this person for whom this work was written by Jeson Kapa, the reason Jeson Kapa wrote it for him because he was a disciple of Jeson Kapa whom Jeson Kapa sent away from him. Jeson Kapa asked him to go away somewhere after this monk had this dream, and Jeson Kapa interpreted the dream, oh, you have to go far away somewhere in Gaowang and you have to build monasteries. And if you go there, it will be very beneficial for the people there. So while he was away over there carrying out his guru's instructions, he begged his guru for teachings, and Jeson Kapa sent him this letter, which is what these 14 verse, which is I think 14 or 15 verses, which is the Lamso Namso. Okay. And at the end of it, and Jeson Kapa demonstrated his deep affection for Tsako Wambo. And it's a very moving line. Yeah. I'm right here, I just open it to it. On page 24. And whenever I read it, whenever I think about it, you know, it moves the heart. In these few beautiful lines, the master implores his disciple to follow his private instructions. He urges him to act and pray in all his lives, as his teacher does. And he invites Ngaung Dakpa to meet him again at the end in enlightenment, where he promises to offer his favored student the first sip of the cup of immortality. This has always been a moving line. I think also very moving for Michael, for Geshe Michael Roach. I guess sometimes whenever you're feeling distant from your teacher, you think of Tsako Wambo and you feel like, oh, I guess it's not bad to be to be too far away from the teacher. Okay. So now I have to, wow, I've answered almost 5 questions already. And Ken Rinpoche, our common teacher, the teacher also of Geshe Banko Roach, studied at Gyalong House in Tibet. And it was at Gyalong House that Ken Rinpoche met with Pabongka Rinpoche. And he was very, very impressed by Pabongka Rinpoche. And he believes that the reason that he became a Larampa Geshe was because of the blessings of Pabongka Rinpoche. And when you know the life of Ken Rinpoche, it's sort of like an inspiration for all of us. He was a goof-off, okay? Not only was he a goof-off, his career was already destined for him. Since you're a goof-off, you're gonna be But since you know how to write, you're going to be the secretary, the assistant of this Geshe, who is going to be moved to this monastery. Okay, that was going to be his career. He was going to be just an assistant. Okay, because he was a goof off. Okay, what he loved to do was to play pranks on on the people with authority. And it's interesting that he became a very stern, authoritative figure. when I first met, when I first heard about Kevin Boucher, I was told to be aware. He's very strict, very stern, he's very wrathful. And even Geshe Michael Roach used to warn me about it. but I had a very different experience with Kenny Boucher. I saw the most compassionate being on the planet when I met him. And I kept saying, what are people talking about? This is supposed to be the most wrathful, the most stern person on the planet. And he was totally the opposite. Well, later on, of course, I started to become acquainted with former students of students who were students of Kevin Boucher when he was a teacher in India. When they hear the name Kevin Boucher, they would shake. Some of them would say that their heads and their knuckles bear the wrath of Kevin Boucher. But one of them said that even though Rinpoche would have the look of wrath, like, you know, Vajrapani stamping on ignorance, and it seemed like he was the veins of his muscles were popping as he was hitting you, you didn't feel anything. That's what they said. But just his anger alone was enough to make you think that you were being whipped alive by Vajrapani. Okay. So Kenin Boche, when he met Pabonga Rinpoche, Pabonga Rinpoche sort of like turned his life around. And because of that, he believed he had the blessings to become a first degree Larampa Geshe. Okay. So it's like inspiration for all of us. Okay. Even if you believe that you believe yourself to be a goof off, you believe yourself to not have enough intelligence, believe yourself to not only you believe that yourself, but other people are sort of reaffirming it for you. You know, you're not going to make it, you know, just forget it. So you can always turn your life around, okay? And I think, I'm not sure where I got this from, but I think Art Engel, one of Rinpoche's students, senior students, mentioned that while Rinpoche was studying, he would study with such intensity that he was asked to stop studying because he was almost gonna have a breakdown. And what was the incident that provoked that? He walked through a window. And you know, in Tibet back then there were no glass. Okay, he just decided to walk through the window. And fortunately for him, it was only two stories, so he didn't break anything. So when his teacher saw that, they told him to take a break. Okay. So, right before he actually achieved this, the first degree Larampa Geshe, Pabonga Rinpoche passed away, and one of Pabonga Rinpoche's chief disciples, Kyabje Tijang Rinpoche, became his root guru. Okay, and that's how he got the name Lobsang Thachen. His ordination name was Thubten Chöpel. And it was ordained by the 13th Dalai Lama. And when you hear that, you say, oh, the 13th Dalai Lama ordained him. It's not really a big deal when the Dalai Lama ordain you. It's not like it's not like the Dalai Lama ordained one person in a year. You know, like he takes time out of his busy schedule and to ordain the exceptional ones. Then when the Dalai Lama ordained people, he ordains like thousands of them at the same time. That's why you have 1,000 people walking around with the name Thubten. And right now, that's why. And what's one of those famous names, Tibetan names that you hear about monks have? Jamba, because the abbot of Serra, his name was, he was stuck at that post for years because no one else wanted it. No one wants to be the abbot of a monastery. Maybe back then in Tibet, people would fight for that position, but in Serra, in the South India, it has responsibility. Okay? So no one wants that responsibility because, you know, these are trained scholars who want administrative duty. You know, you're a scholar, you want to continue with your studies. Now you're free to study on your own, to do your own kind of research. Who wants to be stuck with, you know, administrating 1,000 independently thinking people? Okay? So nobody wanted that job, so Jampa got stuck with that job for a long time. That's why there are a lot of monks named Jampa. And if you know the Jampa in New Jersey, that's why you got the name Jampa. Okay? So the first name, your first name is the name of the person who ordained you. What's the name of the Dalai Lama, the present Dalai Lama? Tenzin Gyatso. And what's the name that you hear a lot? Tenzin. A lot of monks are named Tenzin because his Holiness Dalai Lama ordained him. So every year or so, when he ordains like 1,000 people, or 1,000 people comes out with the name Tenzin. Tenzin something, Tenzin Tinle, Tenzin Gyatso, Tenzin whatever, okay? And Pabongka Rinpoche's name, I think he had like 14 names or something like that. I know Jampa is one of them, Tenzin is in there, Chat Gyatso is in there, Tinle, all those famous Tibetan names is in there somewhere, okay? And Kyabje Tijan Rinpoche was the former student of Pabongka Rinpoche. And he became the root guru of Ken Rinpoche. And as a result of that, that's how Ken Rinpoche had took on the name Lobsang Thachin, because Kyabje Tijan Rinpoche, all that is title. None of that is the name that his mother gave him. Okay, his name was Lobsang Yeshe. Okay, and because of that, Ken Rinpoche became known as Lobsang Thachin, because that's the name that Kyabje Tijan Rinpoche gave him. Okay. Believe it or not, I just gave you the answer to the sixth question. Okay. So, before I finish the rest of this, I get to the story of this, why this book is additionally precious. Because of the kindness of Frank Schwartz, last year I had the pleasure of meeting guess who? The reincarnation of whom the book was written, Tsako Wambo. Of course, when I found out that it was Tsako Wambo, I'm a Westerner, what do I do? Sign the book for me, please. So this is the signature of the reincarnation of Tsako Wambo on the book written for him. And of course, Tibetans, I told you, Tibetans just love not calling you by your name. His name is, let me see if you can guess why he's called that. His name is Tsaon.
Because they put the two together.
Yeah, Tsako Ombo Tsa Wang. His name is Tsaon. Tsaon Rinpoche. So right now he's like 23, I believe. And he's studying at Ganden Monastery. Okay.
At Ganden?
Ganden, yeah. Not Sera, unfortunately for him.
Ganden is in Tibet, still.
Sorry?
Ganden is still in Tibet, right?
Oh, Ganden? Yeah. No, all the monasteries have been translated in India. Yeah, all the, even the smaller monasteries are finding their reestablishment also in India. The three great monasteries, Ganden, Sera, and Jepung, have already been fully translated in India. And they're all actually like almost in the same area right now in South India. And I saw a few pictures of Ganden Monastery in South India, and I was very jealous. It's gorgeous. It's really like, Ganden means the heaven of bliss. It's really like, it looks like a heaven over there. They have garden all over the place, fountains all over the place. I mean, it's like a resort. So if you want to be a scholar, and you also want to stay in a resort, go to Ganden. So now, did that next? Pabong, the present reincarnation of Pabongka Rinpoche is about 37. And he lives somewhere in Nepal. Okay. Now, did this information just confuse you? Or you forgot what I said earlier? What?
He died in 1941.
Uh-huh.
The original Pabongka.
Oh, yeah. Oh, actually, this...
And then there's, so this would be the second...
No, this is not really the... This is not the second Pabongka Rinpoche. This is actually the third Pabongka Rinpoche.
Okay. So two emanations of the same being?
Which being? You remember Pabongka Rinpoche said that I am an incarnation, I'm on a reincarnation of Tsakowambo, right? And Pabongka Rinpoche, the reincarnation of Pabongka Rinpoche, the one who has the name Pabongka Rinpoche, is now living in Nepal. He's about 37 years old, 38 years old. And I met in India, while in Delhi, Tsakowambo Rinpoche, the reincarnation of Tsakowambo. Okay? You're probably confused, and at the same time, to remove the confusion, you're saying, oh, maybe different centuries or something. No. In our present time, while we are living, the reincarnation of Pabongka Rinpoche is in Nepal, and the reincarnation of Tsakowambo lives in South India. One is 30-something, the other one is 20-something. To help you remove that... He showed me a letter written to him because this young man, when he walks into a room, has any of you ever met what's his name, the head of the Kagyu lineage, the Kamapa,
17th.
The 17th Kamapa. Has any of you ever had the pleasure of seeing the 17th Kamapa? Okay. When you see the 17th Kamapa. And you've been hearing about, you know, the Rinpoches, and you meet some people who are called Rinpoches. Say, wait a minute, is this Rinpoche? When you see the 17th Kamapa, you say, this must be a Rinpoche, before you even find out that he's a Rinpoche. I'm telling you, there's a light bulb somewhere within him that's about 100 watts, that everyone admits to me that they've seen. This person glows in the dark, okay? And I've seen it, and I usually don't see anything. I don't see these kind of things. When I saw it, I thought it was the sun, you know, playing tricks on me. But it was, you know, inside a place where there was no windows, so it couldn't have been the sun hitting it. And other people have asked me, "Do you see that light? He glows." Okay. So, the same way that the 17th Kamapa impresses you with his presence. Yeah, that's definitely a Rinpoche. That's definitely some great being. The same way Tsakowambo, Tsako Rinpoche, impresses you. He walks in, it's like, this guy should be king. This guy should be begged to be king because he just has the persona of a king. And he has very, very gentle manners and those kind of things. Why am I saying this? Let me digress a little bit, give you a little story, give you not a long history, but a brief history of Jesongapa. Well, let me just summarize it. Who's Jesongapa is the reincarnation of? Not reincarnation. This time is called an emanation. Is the emanation of? And? No, same being. Mikme Tere Terchen Chenre Zik. Jime Kempe Wombo Jambe Yang. Ganchen Kebe Tsungen Tsongaba. Dupum Malu Wongze Tsongwedak. Tsongwedak. Vajrapani. The mantra of Jesongapa, which is is sort of praising him as being, you are Avalokiteshvara, you are Manjushri, and you are Vajrapani. So, Jesongapa is an emanation of three bodhisattvas, or three Buddhas, depending on what school you're talking. is an emanation of Manjushri, which is mostly what is known as because of his extensive works and his detailed explanation of the most subtle subject in Buddhism, Prasangika Madhyamika. Okay? And he's also known as the emanation of Avalokiteshvara. And he's also known as the emanation of Vajrapani. So all these beings emanated as Jisongapa. So are you confused? Of course. If you're not, I don't know why. So is was there a being who actually became one day Manjushri? Was there another being who actually one day became Avalokiteshvara? Just like one day you will become Buddha John, Buddha James, Buddha Jeremy. Right? So in the same way that you can look at your history in the future, that you will be, this stream of discontinuity will one day be called Buddha so-and-so. So there was a history to some being whose history was one day he became known as Manjushri, Bodhisattva Manjushri, which is Buddha Manjushri, and then Buddha Avalokiteshvara, another one, and then another one who became Buddha Vajrapani. Right? Three beings. And then we talk about one personality, one being Jesongaba, and then these three beings are said to be his emanation. He's supposed to be the emanation of all those three. For your pleasure, I asked this question of Gyume Khenso Rinpoche, the former abbot of Gyume Tantric College, to become the abbot of a tantric of Gyume. Gyume or of Gyuto, you must be a first degree Larampa Geshe. Then you must be a student of Gyume or Gyuto. And then once you finish your studies and you also graduate that with high honors, then you become a candidate to become the abbot of that monastery. Okay. So if I tell you I asked this question of Gyume Khenso Rinpoche, that sort of gives you the background of who I was asking this question. And this is what he said. Because Jesongkapa embodied within himself perfect compassion, he's called an emanation of Avalokiteshvara. Because he embodied within himself perfect wisdom, or wisdom perfectly, he's called an emanation of Manjushri. And because he has perfect power, that he accomplishes deeds perfectly, he's called an emanation of Vajrapani. I said, well, that's a very beautiful answer, right? And of course, I wasn't satisfied. And I asked the question again and in some other ways. And then his attendant, Lobsang, was helping me. Now, he was asking questions. And Lobsang is a Larampa Geshe. And so there was me, the, well, with Lobsang asking Gyume Khenso Rinpoche questions and of how can it be? And then when Gyume Khenso Rinpoche was finished with us, and then now I continue with Lobsang. And Geshe Lobsang said, I'm glad you asked those questions because I had those same questions on myself. Mm-hmm. And he told me, just because Gyume Khenso Rinpoche answered those questions to you doesn't mean that that's the answer. You say you have to go home now and then analyze it and then study it and see if it makes sense to you. And then read and then confer and then what do you call that? Compare. Okay? So, Tsako Rinpoche has what you might call, what do you call those things? Pedigree? When a dog is sort of certified to be, you know, authentically that kind of a dog, and it, because of that, he's worth $1 million. Okay? So because he had this certificate. So Tsako Rinpoche has a certificate from His Holiness the Dalai Lama that says he is indeed Tsako Rinpoche. Okay? So, and Pabongka Rinpoche, somewhere in there, says, I was, in my previous life, that friar named Tsako Rinpoche. And on the planet right now, we have a reincarnation of Pabongka Rinpoche, and another one, which is the reincarnation of Tsakwambo. Now, take this home and then analyze that. Okay. I said I wasn't going to confuse you, and this was the only thing I was going to do to confuse you. So put that aside for a moment. Let's get to the other questions in the homework. Any questions by now? I'm not going to answer who's Tsakwambo, okay? So that goal that you're looking for, that is egging you, that is pressuring you, that is pressing you on, that even though sometimes you feel like giving up, makes you incapable of giving up. And sometimes you may even brainwash yourself to believe that you've given up on that goal. You've given up on the pursuit of happiness. But you're just fooling yourself. It's just another way of making you think that this is how to get the goal. To pretend of not pursuing it. Okay. Maybe if I pretend not to pursue it, I'll finally get there, and that's how I will get there. And I'm sure you've heard a lot of things about that, and especially about this term. A lot of you have become confused, and you wish you were never even introduced to that term, Buddha nature. Because different presentations have been given about that. Sometimes it's been given to you in such a way that you're already enlightened, you just don't know it. So you're like, an omniscient being who lacks one knowledge. The knowledge that he is omniscient. That's my answer to the early enlightened, okay? And another one is that it's just a term referring to your ultimate nature, okay? Buddha nature. It's like your ultimate nature is referred to, it was labeled Buddha nature. Because it is that part of you that will never change. It is that part of you that you will have forever. And what is that part? The fact that you are empty. Okay. And of course, what I've just said sort of like, probably add a little confusion. I said I wouldn't confuse you anymore, right? But here's another thing that confused you. Wait a minute, I thought you heard me say that part of you that doesn't change. And some of you understand the word emptiness to mean there's no such thing as something that doesn't change. Okay. Well, the fact that you're empty is unchanging. Because if it was, how come we're not even doing the first of the path yet? Already I'm talking about emptiness. Correct view, the last part. Okay, but before we get to that, let's just talk a little bit about what are the three principal paths that Jesongapa was describing. And this is supposed to be the essence of everything that the Buddha has ever taught. And in a sense, that verse that the Buddha announced, this is the summary of the teachings of all Buddhas. Avoid all evil. Do all good. Subdue your mind. So you can say with these three also summarizes the three principal paths, the things that you're supposed to do. Avoid all evil can be connected with the first path, renunciation. And in Tibetan, that's Ngen Jung. Renunciation has to do with a recognition, or it's insight. It's an insight into your suffering nature. It's one day you truly realize, wait a minute, I am suffering. And when you truly realize I am suffering, the natural reaction is renunciation. If you're wondering about whether or not you have renunciation, the key element that will determine whether or not you have renunciation is, have you discovered that you're suffering? I've told this story a few times. When I went to Ken Rinpoche's room, and I was complaining about something, like I usually do, and and he said something about, do you know that you're suffering? Do you realize that you are suffering? And that sort of, sort of like a light bulb sort of flashed in my mind. Because I think I was asking something about along the lines of renunciation, you know, give me some book, give me some quote some scholars for me about renunciation. And then you just told me that, okay? So if you realize, I mean truly realize, I am suffering, the natural outcome will be the you will have gained the path called renunciation, okay? Because what happens, you know, as a child, when you touch the, when you touch fire and it burns, what do you do? Do you go look for a book to see, you know, to explain the phenomena to you? Do you go, I have to ask your mother or your father or some authority, or should I stay away from fire next time? You avoid it, you stay away from it, you renounce touching it directly. Okay. And it's not that you are renouncing, you know, because why did you touch the fire in the first place as a little child? Were you thinking, I think I'm going to get burned. I'm going to experience a nice little pain, and I'm going to cry for a few hours, maybe. Let me go experience that. What were you looking for when you touched that fire?
Happiness.
You're looking for nirvana. The brightness of the flame, its color, its dancing, it attracted you. It gave you the impression that there's pleasure in there. There's happiness in there. And it's probably the object of my pursuit. It's probably the object of that of my goal. It's probably the object of that of the reason why I keep look of it's probably that thing that I keep looking for that I don't quite know yet. And if I come in contact with it directly, maybe I'll experience it. And then you touch the fire, and then you get a different reaction. And what usually happens when this happens? When this happens to us, you know, it was fire when you were a little kid. Later on, it's this experience, it's that relationship, it's that person, it's that environment. When you touch it directly, thinking that it was going to give you pleasure instead of give you pain, then, unfortunately, ignorance comes in, and ignorance becomes a big guru for us. Okay, it tells us that goal doesn't exist. See, you were looking for it, and you thought it was there, and it wasn't there. So that goal must not exist. There is no such thing as one day I am happy, one day I'm satisfied. There is no such thing as one day I'm no longer suffering. There is no such thing as what the Buddhists are calling nirvana. And we start to have doubt that the goal that we are by compulsion or pursuing, we start to doubt whether or not this goal exists. Okay. And we start to now do something very strange. We start to behave, we start to analyze, we start to come up with very incredible fancies in our mind. Suffering is something that you just have to learn to accept and just live with forever. And we invent and we do things, crazy things, and we do incredible mental gymnastics to actually make this a reality. And what is the nature of our beings keep doing? What happens when you encounter suffering? What's the natural reaction? You dislike it, you want to get away from it. Because that's the nature of your being. It defines you as a being. If you are a being, by the reason that you're called a being is because you have this particular definition. If it's suffering, you stay away from it. If it's pleasure, you go after it. And this is not going to end. You're not going to stop being a being. And I'm going to quote someone, wasn't a Buddhist, I mean, according to the outside world, Krishna. Krishna said, there will not come a time when you will cease to exist. And there was never a time when you didn't exist. Remember that? In your early years when you were studying the Bhagavad Gita? Well. That was a long time ago, and that's the only thing I remember. And also there was a battle somewhere. So there will never come a time when you will stop wanting to experience pleasure. And there will never come a time when you will just live with suffering. Your being, your definition will always make you get away from suffering. Okay. So when you realize, when you really realize this is suffering, the next thing, the natural outcome is, I'm going to stay away from what causes this. Okay. When you allow wisdom to be your guru rather than ignorance, those list of things that you're supposed to do that makes you not create the cause for this experience is called wisdom. Okay. And those body of knowledge has to do with the last path, which is called correct view or wisdom. Okay. And eventually, seeing the true nature of reality directly. That is the most powerful and the only antidote to truly put an end to suffering. And you can see how they relate, right? It's not that if you want to end suffering, you must change your culture, you know, you must stop being a Westerner, start wearing those, what is the Tibetan thing called? Chubas. You must start wearing a chuba. You must adopt this strange philosophy called Buddhism. And then you must force yourself to accept this thing as wisdom, this thing about emptiness, the true nature of reality, and then you will escape it. And of course, if that's how you're forcing yourself to take on this knowledge, to take on the Dharma, you will fight with it. And if you're not fighting with it, something is wrong with you. Okay? If you think that you have to change culture, you have to somehow become a different kind of a human being in order for you to get out of being a suffering being altogether, then if you're not fighting with that idea that it maybe is being presented to you, that there's something wrong with you. Okay? I think it tells me it's about time, right? If you realize, if you come to the realization, to the knowledge, I am suffering. Not that someone tells you, oh, there's something called suffering, and here's the book that talks about it. It was written by this guy, you know, in the 18s, whatever, and he was known to be a great scholar. And you have to force yourself to say, wait a minute, I am suffering, because it says so in the book. Okay? You will never reach renunciation. But if you, without even ever once reading a word of Lamso Namsum or any other thing, you never even heard the word Buddhism or Dharma or scripture, but you realize, I am suffering, the natural reaction is, I want to know what the cause of this suffering is. And by when I know the cause of this suffering, I'm going to stay away from it. Because you directly know it. And that thing that acts directly against suffering, that's wisdom. It's perfectly logical now, right? That's why it's called wisdom. Okay? Now, if you want to go a step further, there's a path in the middle. And I'm sort of like, campaign against trivializing this path. Because it is mighty. Okay. It's the path of the Bodhisattva. You become a Bodhisattva when you have actual bodhicitta in your mind. That's the second path. So the first path is realizing that you are suffering, you gain the first path, which is renunciation. And when you realize that, wait a minute, I'm not the only one suffering. My mother is suffering, my sister is suffering, my brother is suffering, my friends are suffering. Even the person who is causing me harm, the person who is a pain in my life, is also suffering. And you want to gain wisdom not only to end your suffering, but to be empowered in such a way that you are able to end the sufferings of others. And it becomes your career. It becomes your job. then you become a bodhisattva. Then you've gained the second path, bodhicitta. Okay. And until you actually have a direct perception of emptiness, and the word, of course, the word emptiness has become just an exotic word now because we hear it a lot. Okay. When you directly perceive what is the true nature of reality, where do things really come from? Where does my suffering really come from? What is the nature of my experience that I have to experience it? When you get to the true nature of things, directly perceive it, then you've gained the third path, which is correct view, correct understanding, okay, which is also wisdom. Okay. And the reason for these three paths altogether, with the first path and the third path, you can get out of suffering. You can get out of samsara. Okay. That's all you need. But to achieve Buddhahood, to achieve that state we talked about, blissful omniscience, you must have the second path, you must realize the second path, bodhicitta. Okay. Now, let me describe to you a little bit the goal that you're looking for. Okay. I already summarized it by saying it is blissful omniscience. Right? There are two things standing in your way right now that is why you're not at this very moment, you cannot call yourself a pleasantly omniscient being, a blissfully omniscient being. One is called Shidrip, and the other one is called Nyundrip. Nyundrip is actually what prevents you from no longer having to ever experience suffering and ever in your existence. Nyundrip is called, I guess you can call that mental affliction obstacles. Nyun, deep. Mm-hmm. It is what keeps us suffering. It is what keeps us in samsara. These obstacles. Okay. And it is because we are taking the advice, we are taking refuge in ignorance. And we don't do it because we consciously go and say, this is the wrong idea, let me adopt it. Because we think it is the correct view. We think it is the correct it's the correct knowledge. But we are mistaken. Okay. So ignorance is not that that term that we understand as, what's that thing? Bliss is ignorance? Ignorance is bliss. It's not in that context where, if you don't know it, then you're okay. Okay? It's not the sense of ignorance in the sense of I don't know what the true nature of reality is. It's more in a sense of I am affirming something opposite to that. That is what ignorance is. It's not that I don't know what the nature of reality is. I'm saying the nature of reality is this. And what am I saying it is? I'm saying it is the total opposite of what it is truly. Things are empty. I'm saying things are not empty. Of course, it's not something intellectual. It's, you don't have to go to school to become this kind of ignorant. Okay? Just being, you possess this kind of ignorance. And the reason I'm saying that you're not doing it consciously, it's not when you call someone ignorant, you're putting them down, you're insulting them. So within Buddhist philosophy, when you're called ignorant, you're not being belittled. You're not being insulted, okay? Something went wrong in your pursuit of the goal. The goal that you're seeking when you lit a cigarette, when you light a cigarette. The goal that you're seeking at the bottom of the glass of gin. The goal that you're seeking in your relationships. In your career, that very goal that you're looking for, in the pursuit of it, you are mistaken. And because of your mistaken understanding, the actions that you did, the actions that you undertook to get to that goal, these are shidji, nyundri. Okay. Those very actions that are mistaken, in pursuing nirvana, essentially, because at the end they don't get you to nirvana. You know, when you at the end of chocolate ice cream, you think you're gonna get nirvana, but when you get to the bottom of it, you're still looking for nirvana. So you get another pint, another pint, and then you end up with stomachache and then that kind of stuff. Okay, thinking that I'm gonna get nirvana at the end of the pint of ice cream. That mistaken idea is ignorance. It's connected with ignorance. Okay, I somehow wrongly believe that the pleasure that I'm experiencing at the first spoon of ice cream is truly coming from the ice cream, because you know there's a direct experience that seems to affirm that. Okay, I cannot deny that I like the taste, that I'm experiencing some kind of pleasure when I'm eating this ice cream. So I draw a conclusion which seems to be logical. The pleasure comes from the ice cream. But when you do a very simple logic, no, you don't have to graduate from Einstein University. Just a very simple logic. If this is the cause of happiness, the more I have of it, the more happy I should be. But when you have more of it, you don't end up with happiness. You end up with something else, the opposite of happiness. So the natural conclusion should be, this is not the cause of happiness. Okay. And just drawing this simple conclusion, you're on the path of wisdom. Okay. And it still has to do with direct experience. It has nothing to do with, you know, you have to borrow your teacher's omniscience, and you have to wait for him to give it to you, because if he doesn't give it to you, then you're stuck. It doesn't matter how many years you study, how many years you meditate, until he you know has pity on you. Say, okay, here's a little bit of here's the experience. Now you know the truth. It has to do with your direct, with your own mind, with your own ability to reason, your own ability to evaluate your experience and evaluate it without prejudice. Okay. And all that you have to take into consideration with all those things I talked about earlier. Even with the thing about it's Tsakuombo, the one who's in South India, really Tsakuombo, for whom Jason Kapa wrote that. And was Pabonga Rinpoche really Tsakuombo? Or is Pabonga Rinpoche really Pabonga Rinpoche? Does it really matter? All those kinds of things. Don't create a reality in order for you to accept certain things. Okay. If it doesn't make sense to you, it doesn't make sense to you. It doesn't mean that something is wrong with you necessarily. Okay. It doesn't mean that because you have bad karma, you did a bunch of awful things, you killed a few million kings, you kill your mother a few million times, and because of that, that's why you cannot understand this. Doesn't necessarily mean that. It could be, I don't know. But it doesn't necessarily mean that. Okay. It doesn't mean that you're wrong for when something doesn't make sense to you. Now, you shouldn't go and draw another conclusion inadequate facts. It's just that right now, factually speaking, this is what it appears to be. And just accept it that way. And maybe later on, something deeper about this experience I will be able to gain insight about. For now, there are two people who are being told by others whom we respect to be the reincarnation of one person. And we are also told that Jason Kaba is the emanation of three different beings. So maybe we are supposed to understand it a different way than we are understanding it presently. Okay. Maybe it is truth. Maybe at the same time it is also false. Maybe. Okay. And the most important thing is, how relevant is it to you? How relevant is all those things I'm saying about this guy named Tsakwambo and this Rinpoche and this other Rinpoche? How relevant is it to you? How will it help you get to your goal? How will it help you finally reach the point where you fulfill the reason why you're sitting in the classroom and this guy is making you stay after hours? Okay? How is that going to help you, truly help you? In the tradition of this is a Lam Rim text, and the reason it's called a Lam Rim because it presents all the stages of the path to how you can achieve your ultimate goal, all the different things that you have to do, all the different things that you have to realize, summarized in just three principles. Okay, if you develop renunciation and bodhicitta and correct view, it doesn't matter what else you do, it doesn't matter what else, what other knowledge you acquire or you fail to acquire, unless you develop those three paths, you will not achieve Buddhahood. Okay. So whatever path you're following, no matter how many steps it has, it must have these three things in it. Okay. So in the tradition of Lam Rim, usually the person who's teaching, who's introducing the topic, would talk about how you should listen to the teachings. And there's this tradition of explaining how the student should listen. Okay, the three faults, it's called the three faults of a pot. Okay, consider a pot. Consider your brain, your mind, consider it to be like a pot, okay? If it has a hole in it, when you put water in the pot, what happens if it has a hole in it? The water seeps out and there's a point where there's no water in the pot, okay? So you should not listen with a leaky brain. Unfortunately, a lot of us cannot help with that, okay? So you just have to try as hard as you can to listen with as much intensity as you can. And the only way, and what will help with the intensity is this gonna help me reach my goal? If you listen with intensity, this listening to how am I gonna reach my goal, that will help you plug the holes you have in your mind. Okay. And that a metaphor for listening to instructions, and because our mind is naturally distracted by things, a lot of things comes in and it just goes out. We forget. That's for forgetting. Okay. And another problem that we may have is the pot upside down. And what happens if you try to put water in an upside down pot? No water gets in there. So try to listen with such intensity that you actually are able to at least feel the water. Even though there might be a hole in your mind that you know, this is that's the part that you inherited from your previous life. Unfortunately, it already has holes in it, and you didn't fix all the holes already. So you can't wait for you to fix all the holes before you start listening to Dhamma. Maybe by listening to Dhamma, maybe some of the water will crystallize, and then the water itself will plug the holes. Okay, so at least. If when the pot has a hole, the water, you actually feel the water. You have at least a memory of the water being there. But if the pot is upside down, there's not even the memory of the water being there, of the Dhamma being there. And then there's listening with the pot dirty. Okay. And what happens when you put clean water in a dirty pot? The water comes out dirty. And this is something very important. It's very important to every Buddhist tradition. not just Tibetan tradition, not just Chinese tradition. I mean, every tradition that is a Buddhist tradition tries to avoid that. And every tradition that you hear about, whether it is new, whether it is old, claims to be a tradition that avoided receiving the Dharma in a dirty vessel. And this is now causing a big controversy. I mean, it always caused a big controversy, but now there's now a prison controversy because of that. Who has the pure Dharma? Who has it? Do the Tibetans have it? Among the Tibetans, who has it? The Gelugpas? The Nyingmas? The Kagyus? The Sakyas? What's the other one called? Someone said it.
Rime
is a tradition studied very recently in history. It was a tradition to end all sectarianism within the four major sects of Buddhism in Tibet. And that became its own sect. But it sort of died down, but it seems that His Holiness is trying to revive the essence of it. At least the essence of it. I'm not sure if His Holiness wants to make a new... definitely His Holiness doesn't want to make a new sect, but he speaks in such ways that he wants to revive the essence of it. The essence of it, where someone studies from all the schools. Now, if the Tibetans are the ones who have it, does that mean that the Chinese don't have it? And within the Chinese, which school has it? The Pure Land School? What's the other school? The Chen School? Among the Chen School, how many Chen schools are there? There are like a few Chen schools. Which one has it? And there's Japanese. There's Theravadan. There's Burmese, there's Taiwan, there's Vietnamese. All these different kinds of traditions of Buddhism. Which one has the pure Dharma? And this has caused death. Okay. And fortunately, it hasn't raised wars among nations or among, but at certain points it almost did sometimes. So how do you avoid listening to the Dharma with your own prejudices? I mean, you can help it, right? You already have your preconceived ideas about the nature of things, and then some text or some tradition is giving you ideas. Okay, this is Dharma. This is the true nature of reality. This is what you're supposed to do, and you're supposed to interpret it with your own reasons. How do you avoid not staining this?
Motivation.
And that itself can be stained. Right? So connected with motivation, I'll go back to a very pure, basic thing. What I said from the very beginning. The goal you're looking for. How sincere are you in pursuing that goal? How clear are you about how faithful are you about the existence of that goal? Maybe what you need to do to get to that goal, you have to mix the schools. Or maybe you better not mix the schools. Or maybe you have to do something completely different. And the only way for you to truly know that is you have to be true to the pursuit of your goal. Be true to the pursuit of your goal, that will be your guru. And that will lead you to different places or to different persons or to different teachings that you need to acquire it. The tradition that's studied by Jesongkapa is, let me see how good you are. What was his date? 1357, 1490, very good. And Jason Kabat then started a tradition called the Gelugpas. Even though the Gelugpas is attributed to having to its founder being Jason Kapa. Jason Kapa then go to Gelugpa school to become the great Jason Kapa. He studied with the Sakyas, with the Nyingmas, and the Kagyus who preceded him. Okay. So what did he do? He reinterpreted Madhyamika. And because of his revolutionary interpretation of Madhyamika, that's really the difference between the different schools, between the Gelugpa and the other schools. And later, because of separation, you know, when you have two people of the same culture, you separate them, after a few generations, they become totally completely different people of different cultures, right? So in the same way, because of time, then Gelugpas started to have very distinctive features other than just the revolutionary interpretation of Madhyamika by Jason Kapa. Okay. And of course, there were other things in there. And why did Jason Kapa do that? He wasn't receiving the pure Dharma? No? I mean, so he had to clean it up? And if he wasn't receiving the pure Dharma, what was he using as an image or as a model? Or this is what I have to take out so that it can be pure. What was his criteria? What was his guru? The goal. To use a, I'm not gonna use it. So don't be scared about this thing called the pure Dharma. The pure Dharma can only be within you. It cannot exist in the tradition. And if there cannot be any such thing as this tradition is keeping the pure Dharma, forget about a pure tradition. Don't let that be because for a lot of people, that becomes a stumbling block. That becomes an obstacle, trying to keep the tradition pure. And in trying to keep the tradition pure, you end up building another tradition. And that creates, right now, that is creating, I mean, right now, that is creating a battle. There's a battle being waged right now. And right now, you can say, the different camps are gathering their strength for one of the things that the Buddha said to be the worst thing that could happen to a community. Division. As though, you know, the world is not the situation in the world is not bad enough. So we are right now in the middle of experiencing what will be a major schism in the community. Okay. The lines are drawn, and people are what do you call that? Stepping to your no, taking sides.
Okay. Why are Buddhist schools doing that?
Because we are human beings. We can't help it. It has nothing to do with the Buddha, the purity of the Dharma. It has nothing to do with the teachings of Buddhism.
But in relation to status, if high practitioners are truly understanding the Dharma, how can they?
Yeah, how can that happen?
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah, that's my question too. How can it happen that teachers that we admire, that we want to prostrate through, to are fighting with each other? Remember the goal, remember your pursuit of the goal, and that's your true guru. And then there is the manifestations. They're also teaching you something. Sometimes they teach you, think for yourself. Sometimes that's what they're teaching you. And that's one of the things that I just recently came to truly admire about my teacher, Ken Rinpoche. And I cannot tell you the details of it, but I truly admired him for that, because he left us to think for ourselves. He never gave us what you call those things. Well, a lot of things I mean. Sorry?
Never told us
what to think.
Right,
never, like absolute, never gave us any absolutes. He just said, this is what it's in the Dharma. This is what it said. And something that, a gift that he gave me just recently. Now we have Jason Kapa, 1357, 1419. Pabonka Rinpoche, 1878, 1941, I think, I don't know. Tujan Rinpoche, 1901, 1981, something like that. I mean, really, it's in the book, okay, somewhere. And then we come to Ken Rinpoche, 1921, 2004. Right? And just recently, before his passing, he gave me this gift. He said, Buddhists are independents. You're free to think according to your own mind. Okay. No one is forced to think a specific way. No one is forced to say, that's Pabonka Rinpoche, whatever he says, I must do. No one is forced to say, that's, you know, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, whatever he says, that's what I have to do. You're still left to your own mind to decide. And Ken Rinpoche, although he was in the middle, very middle, midst of this rift that is beginning with the Dharma, he never forced his students to take sides. And you never know what sides he was on, if he was on any side. Okay, almost finished. Okay, and the three principal paths, we name them, the three problems of the path, we name them number eight. This one, it's gonna be very brief, it's gonna be the last thing. I already answered number 10, if you will, okay, towards the end. Can you hold on to it? Remember it? Okay. You cannot just by hearing this start categorizing yourself. I mean, that's the natural tendency. I mean, when I first heard this, and I went home, and I said, am I Kibu Ding or Kibu Chungu or Kibu Chembo? You know, a person of small capacity. I mean, no one wants to call himself a person of small capacity. Of course, we naturally throw that away. And a middling person. I mean, no one wants to be mediocre, because that's what we associate this with. Or a person of great capacity. Okay? So we go home and try to force ourselves to see which category we fit. You know? This is not what the teaching is about. It's not telling you what category you fit. It doesn't have to do with what you consciously decide right now. It has something with something much more deeper than that. What are you naturally doing? Okay? Just because you're within the tradition called Mahayana, not even Mahayana, but Vajrayana tradition, doesn't make you a Vajrayanist. Just because you have 10 initiations from His Holiness the Dalai Lama doesn't make you a Vajrayanist. Okay? And this has nothing to do with deciding whether you're Tibetan Buddhist or Theravadan or Chinese Buddhist. It has nothing to do with that. It has to do with inner compulsions. When a situation is like when the the actual situation comes up. What is your instinctive refuge? What do you truly believe will give you happiness or give you protection? What do you grab that instinctively to give you that protection or to give you that satisfaction? That's your true. It doesn't say. That's the person you really are in terms of the divisions. And that's what you have to transform. Okay? And it's in here somewhere. I think in the life of Jesongapa, where Lamsom Namsum was dictated to Jesongapa by Manjushri. I mean, you can, if that inspires you to believe that, then believe it. If it's not, you know, if it doesn't help you in your path, maybe you don't have to believe it. Okay, it's just the way the story is told. Okay. Jesongapa was dictated to by Manjushri, the Lamso Namso. And somewhere in there, Pabonga Mbuche explains in the life story of Jesongapa. Jesongapa was already a realized scholar. He was already teaching. He had many followers. And Manjushri supposedly appeared to him and told him the three principal paths: renunciation, bodhicitta, and then correct view. And then Manjushri talked to him about the three beings, the three types of beings: the smaller capacity, the middling capacity, and the great capacity. And of course, Jesongapa did like we do. So Manjushri, you know, which being am I? But the story, I'm doing what tradition does, you know, change stories when they're telling it. The actual situation was about wisdom, the four schools. And Jesongapa was asking Manjushri, you know, was asked by Jesongapa, which of the four schools, which tenet do I instinctively hold? You know, there's the lowest one, there's the little bit bigger, higher than that, there's the higher than that, and then there's the highest. And of course, everybody wants to think that they're somewhere close to the highest. The different interpretation of the true nature of reality, the four schools. And Manjushri told Jesongapa, who was a renowned writer, he had many followers, many students, he's done a few retreats. Manjushri told him, you're not even the first one. Okay? So don't rack your brains tonight trying to figure out which of the three scopes you fit, which of the three divisions. Am I Kebu Ding, Kebu Chungo, Kebu Chembo? Okay? What is the smallest capacity? When your instincts tells you, I just want to end suffering. You're not thinking anything further. It's not that you say, I hate those people, I'm not gonna free them. It's not you thinking, I have a grudge with that group or with that type of being. I don't like mosquitoes, no, they're bothersome. They should stay as mosquitoes, I'm not gonna rescue them from suffering. It's not that you're actively thinking those kinds of thoughts. The only active thought you're thinking is, I am suffering, I wanna get out. And I want to get out for good. When your natural instinct is that, then you're practicing, you're studying to achieve the aim of that, then you are a person of small capacity. So if you're not even worried about your future life, you're not even working, you don't even accept that there are future life, you're not even trying to even get to have a better future life, you're not even doing anything for that, then you're not even someone of small capacity. Someone of small capacity is a great spiritual being. Okay? When you actually become someone of small capacity, that means you are actively working to get out of samsara. Not thinking of doing so, not trying to do so, but you're actively working to do so. It is your obsession. Okay. And when you don't care what happens to you, and all you think about is, I have to help other beings get out of suffering. And that's all that matters to you. Not that you're thinking, I want to get to a paradise so I can become omniscient, so I can know everything, so I can have a planet or universe that is all under my domain, where everything gives me bliss, so then I can help other people stop suffering. If you're thinking that way, you are not a bodhisattva. You're not someone who is of the great capacity. But when all you're obsessed about is ending the sufferings of beings, and because of trying to acquire the means of ending the sufferings of sentient beings, you somehow stumble into Buddhahood. That kind of being is the great being who does this instinctively. That's a being of great capacity. Okay. And by instinct, I mean the very things that you do every day. What is the underlying reason why you do it? The things that you do instinctively. Okay. Actually, Kebu, the person who's of middling capacity, is the one who wants to leave suffering for good. The person of smallest capacity is the person who wants to leave suffering in this life. Okay, they want to end the suffering of this life, so they're focusing on achieving a future life where they're not suffering the way they're suffering right now. So they want to become a god. They want to topple Indra. They want to become the next Brahma. Or they just want to be some angel in heaven, you know, with beautiful wings, with 100 feet span. And in order for you to achieve that aim, you must be a great spiritual being. You must be a spiritual being. You do not become Brahma, you do not become Indra, or someone with a halo, which is 500 foot span, by being selfish. By having any kind of selfish attitude. And the reason I'm saying this is because some people equate selfishness or lack of selfishness with being a bodhisattva. That is not enough. You have to not be selfish and some other things in order for you to have the title bodhisattva. In order for you to achieve just the first goal, the goal of the smallest capacity, you must stop being selfish. The way we understand how it is to be selfish. Okay. And forget about the one who wants to get out of suffering altogether. The one who wants to achieve nirvana, or the end of samsara existence, which is the middling capacity. And the one who wants to achieve the great capacity, the goal of the great capacity, must have no concern for their own suffering. Not that they go around inflicting pains upon themselves, thinking that will help them reach their goal. But you have that kind of attitude, you have that kind of compassion, that kind of concern for others' welfare, where if the path to end the suffering of others is for you to experience pain, you will gladly experience it. If you have to be the one who gets stuck in samsara forever, you will gladly do it if it what will end the suffering of others. So, in this way, you should consider the three scopes. They are instincts, spiritual instincts. Okay. If your instinct is about the future life, and you're a moral person, in order to achieve that aim, you're practicing to achieve that aim, and you're mastering concentration, you're avoiding evil, you're doing all that is good, and you're mastering your mind for that aim, then you're a person of small capacity. If you're avoiding evil, doing all good, mastering your mind in order to end suffering altogether, then you're middling capacity. And what's the path of the last of the greatest one? Let me see now. If you avoid all evil, do all that is good, master your mind, and then the aim is to become someone who ends the sufferings of others, then you are someone of great capacity. So you could be doing tantra, and instinctively you're not even the first level. You just want a future better. You just want this life to be better. Maybe you just want, you're doing tantra so that you can get a better job. Or you're doing tantra so that you can become the next Indra. Okay? Or you can be doing tantra where the end of it is to bring the end of sufferings of all beings. And that's your instinct. And it takes time, it takes effort to get to that kind of capacity. It's not something that you gain overnight. Okay? Don't beat yourself up just because you're not of that capacity yet, instinctively. You have it, you have the motivation to get there, you have the motivation to be that being, and that's great, and that's a necessary component, and you have to nurture it. Okay. And one day, instinctively, just breathing will be a means for you to end the sufferings of all beings. Okay. And on that note, we'll end the class.
Just a question. Mm-hmm. What would you recommend me to say when I meet some people who say they don't experience suffering? They love this world, they feel good.
It's because they're not really looking at their life. They're doing, I forgot that term in psychology, where you pretend something, pretend a different reality? To denial. They're in denial. Okay. I don't care who you are. If you're not a Buddha, you're suffering. That's point blank.
At some point in time.
Yeah.
Not all the time.
No, suffering is not like you're in hell all the time. Suffering means I'm not a Buddha. That's what suffering doesn't mean that I am under. I'm being hit by a truck, 24 hours a day. That's not what suffering means. Suffering means I'm not a Buddha. Okay. So you can actually be a being where you see yourself as the owner of the galaxy, and you're issuing orders. Okay, build a planet there. Okay, destroy that planet over there. Okay, and you can actually see yourself as that kind of a being. And you have no idea what it is to suffer the way humans experience suffering. That's not a state of Buddhahood. That state is suffering because it has to end. Okay, that's what I mean by suffering. Maybe we have to use a different term in English or something other than suffering, because suffering seems to evoke the image of someone being crushed by a truck all the time or something. Okay. So it doesn't mean that necessarily. So that kind of experience, of course, we're not having it all the time. But the state of not being a Buddha, until you reach a Buddha, you're experiencing it until you're a Buddha. So that state, everything that is included within that, is included within the term suffering. Okay.
Excuse me. For another term besides suffering, this other term, could we say impermanent? Because what we, when we look at the chocolate ice cream, thinking that it's gonna bring us some type of permanent happiness. I mean, this is what we all ask for myself, but what we want. And if you're not a Buddha, then you're suffering, right?
Yeah.
But this other word, impermanence.
Yeah,
use this?
Yeah, impermanence is used sometimes as an equivalent. Yeah, for samsara. For the sufferings, for state of suffering. Because the experiences that you experience, the pleasure experiences that you experience in samsara are impermanent. They don't last. Okay, so we'll end class with the mandala and then the gewadi. What do you call that? The dedication.
Sanam yeshe pejong way, tambah.